Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no hollow, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul, whatever thou be, until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
Hello, Dan. I'm Lulu.
Hello, Lulu.
Hello.
Just real quick, want to thank hundreds of you for the recent ratings and reviews across numerous platforms. Thank you so much. Excited to keep trying to keep these episodes fresh. And we have a slew of new ideas for more nightmare fuel stories to share with you and working with the researchers.
I'm just making faces at you over here.
Scarier, scared to death stories. And yeah, excited to keep it going.
I'm excited too.
Yeah.
It is fun.
It is fun. Yeah. It is fun.
I was trying to see if you'd catch me making funny faces at you.
No. How many stories do you have today? How many fan-submitted allegedly true paranormal horror stories do you have?
I have a haunted house trifecta.
Ooh, I like that.
I know. So fun. So I have a good old haunted house with a classic parent who just doesn't believe their child until they do.
Okay.
Which is often how it goes. And then another haunted house, another non-believing parent. I think that we just really have to teach these grown-ups some lessons.
All right.
And then my third haunted house tale, a bit different from the first two, will take us back to the Whaley House. If you will recall, in San Diego, you covered the Whaley House.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on episode 65 back in December of 2022.
Wow,
so
yeah.
Quite a ways up.
I think I do remember which one that was.
Quite a ways back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, three really awesome stories.
Well, I have my normal two. The first revolves around Black Aggie, the name of a statue that sat for years in a Maryland cemetery and attracted a number of paranormal claims, many of which were actually featured in various articles in the Baltimore Press.
That feels so familiar.
It'll ring a bell once we get into it. My second takes us to back, actually, since we've talked about Cherokee folklore before. This time, we're going to visit the story of the Yunwi Junsti, a.k.a. the Little People. I'll share legends and supposed sightings of this mystical race, I guess, of people. Most of my stories coming from the area of Hickory Nut Gorge in North Carolina.
Okay.
So you ready to begin?
Guess what?
What?
This week?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you can lift your leg up?
I can put my legs up. I started PT and my doctor said it's okay.
Nice.
Guys, look. Now, these are difficult to see.
they are just in shadow.
I know. Now, fine. Look at these little alligators. Look at these guys.
That's cute.
They're like little crocheted, and your foot goes in the mouth.
Oh, yeah. That is fun.
So silly. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud I can put my feet up.
So many different socks. Good job.
Making little progress. You're telling me.
Okay, so fair amount of historical setup for this first story. Then we're going to be off into some creepy supposed encounters that, yeah, were actually printed in the newspaper, which is not the norm. For many of us, there are a few things on this earth creepier than old statues and cemeteries. They stand as eternal witnesses of the grief of thousands, their stone faces streaked with tears of rain, their features eroded and the jagged made smooth by time, watching woefully over the buried and the dead. For 41 years, the Druid Ridge Cemetery in Pikesville, Maryland, was home to one such lonesome figure who became known simply as Black Aggie. The monument is of a seated woman, veiled in the heavy layers of a funeral shroud that cast deep shadows on her somber face, twisted in mourning. Although it went on to gather a distinct reputation of its own, Black Aggie is actually an unauthorized replica of a more famous statue properly known as Grief. The statue Grief was made in 1891 by one of the fathers of the American architectural Renaissance, Augustus St. Gaudens, at the behest of his friend Henry Adams, who had recently lost his wife Marion. A few years prior, Marion had fallen into an incredible, suffocating grief that consumed her waking days and sleepless nights after her beloved father suddenly died. She was incredibly close to her father, and soon after his death in 1885, she committed suicide by drinking potassium. Her husband, Henry Adams, a renowned historian and the grandson of President John Quincy Adams, was now overcome with unbearable grief himself. Originally, he buried Marion at the Rock Creek Cemetery in Washington, D.C., with a simple headstone. But it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it was enough. He thought his late wife deserved so much more, so he commissioned Augustus St. Gaudens to build her a funerary statue. The instructions he gave to Augustus have been lost to time, but just from looking at the silent agony carved into the statue's face, you can tell that Henry wanted the sculpture to embody both the profound pain Marion felt and the grief her husband was now left with. When the statue was completed by St. Gaudens, Marion's headstone was removed and replaced by the haunting figure, and immediately upon its installment, curious visitors began flocking to it like moths to a flame. The statue became infamous, partly because of its peculiar appearance and partly because of Henry's odd behavior and attitude around it. For starters, Henry refused to name the statue. Grief was simply what people came to call it. He even refused to have an inscription or plaque placed on the monument to indicate, if not its own name, at least the name of the dead whom it guards. This was fairly unsurprising to those who knew him well, though, given he rarely acknowledged his wife's death in private and never in public. Additionally, he had a barrier of foliage placed around the statue so it was barely visible to the casual passerby and difficult to reach without getting scraped by more than a few branches. Much to Henry's dismay, his attempts to protect Grief from the public only added fuel to their desire to see it firsthand, and it eventually became a must-see landmark in D.C. guidebooks and magazines. Try as he might, he couldn't stop the people's insatiable need to look in the haunting face of Grief and gaze upon his torment. Grief also caught the attention of other artists, and within a few months of the statue being placed on Marion Adams' grave, it was evident that multiple casts had been already made of it. Particularly unnerving, early on, the face of Grief was forever tainted by an amateur casting attempt, and residue of that molding is still evident today. Though it's unclear whether or not he acquired the partial casting himself, one of the artists to make a copy of Grief was a man named Edward Ludwig Ponch. And in 1905, Ponch's copy was purchased by famed French-born sculptor, soldier, and newspaper publisher, General Felix Agnes. So I guess it'd be French-born sculptor. Felix had lived in the States since 1861, had served in the 5th New York Volunteer Infantry in the American Civil War, and served 4 years, where he served 4 years and rose quickly to the rank of general. During his time in the Army, Felix was respected by many, and after the war was over, he was even offered multiple political positions, including U.S. consul, but the former sculptor declined every time. Instead, after the war, he moved to Baltimore and worked for the Baltimore American, where he eventually became the publisher and a founder of the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. In 1905, Felix began building an Agnes family monument in the Druid Ridge Cemetery, and he purchased Ponch's replica of Grief to be the centerpiece. The replica was nearly exact, except the stone was a nondescript gray instead of pink granite like the original, and the name Agnes was inscribed on the pedestal. Like its inspiration, the Agnes family monument soon became the talk of the town. So much so that the wife of the now dead Augustus St. Gaudens traveled to Baltimore to see the statue for herself. She was outraged at the unauthorized replica of her husband's work and wrote a letter to Henry Adams saying that General Angus must be a good deal of a barbarian to copy a work of art in such a way. General Felix Agnes ended up having to pay $4,500 to the sculptor's widow, but refused to give up his statue. Shortly after the monument was finished, Felix had his mother's body exhumed from her resting place in France and shipped to Baltimore so she could be buried in the new family tomb. In 1922, when Felix's wife Annie died, she too was buried under the replica statue. Then on Halloween night, 1925, General Felix Angus died in his home and, per his request, was buried next to his wife under his beloved statue. And that's when the stories and the horror began. Time now for the tale of the face of grief. An article from a 1966 issue of the Baltimore Evening Sun summarizes many of the stories around the statue. The sorority girl was dead as the bronze statue in whose lap she sprawled, deader perhaps. A knife pierced the girl's heart. The blade was long and silvery and the murder itself unsolvable. The only clues lay scattered through decades of Baltimore history, reports that came spasmodically through the years of unsolved mysteries revolving around Black Aggie and the grave she guards with strange vengeance in Druid Ridge Cemetery. No fertilizer known can make grass grow in her shadow. And at midnight, when breezes sigh darkly in black hemlock needles at her mantles, he rolls her eyes at the full of the moon, and her arm lifts in protest of some forgotten injustice. Persons who have returned the gaze of those glowing eyes have been struck blind. Young mothers who have walked too close by at midnight have suffered stillbirths. Countless strollers have quickened their steps at the sound of wails and pain and clanking chains. Given the horrifying accounts of Black Aggie's murderous and mystical behavior, it's no wonder that for 41 years, teenagers flocked to the statue in the dark of night to witness the stories, and perhaps the statue herself come to life. John Hitchcock, who was not only the Druid Ridge Cemetery superintendent in the 1960s, but was also raised in the cemetery, as his dad held the position before him, was once quoted saying, "Anyone who goes out there to look at that grave at midnight is out of his ever-loving mind." In the darkness of the empty cemetery, most of these audacious teenagers experience only the anxious thrill of triple dog dares and gain nothing but bragging rights for the fact that they sat on Black Aggie's lap and survived. But others, believers in Black Aggie's powers and non-believers alike, were greeted with far more than they bargained for when they hopped over the graveyard fence and sought out grief's replica in the maze of buried bodies and faded headstones. In 1976, the Evening Sun reported that shortly after Black Aggie was erected in the Druid Ridge Cemetery, an initiate from an unknown fraternity was brought before the stone woman and told to sit on her lap until sunrise. According to the article, the young man agreed, and late one night he climbed onto the throne as his snickering friends departed. At the stroke of midnight, the wind suddenly died, Black Aggie's arms slowly began to move, and a scream pierced the air. The night watchman rushed up and stopped in his tracks. There, at Black Aggie's feet, lay the stone-dead youth, his face a mask of terror. The doctor said he died of fright, but his friends knew differently. The boy met his death in Aggie's chilly embrace. More than pregnant women or casual tourists, these are the people that Black Aggie seemingly targets, thrill-seeking kids. The article I read from earlier stated that Aggie's arm rises in protest of some forgotten injustice. But is it really? Is the injustice she seeks vengeance for truly a mystery? There's debate about who Black Aggie really is, or more accurately, what resides within her. Some say it's the force of suffering itself, manifested in the coldness of the stone woman's stare, and that the terror that seizes your heart and paralyzes your mind when you stand under her gaze is simply the wretched anguish and sorrow of the thousands of mourners who have buried their loved ones in the soil beneath your feet. Others say it's a literal demon that inhabits Black Aggie, one that seeks only to take advantage of those vulnerable mourners that cross its path, and the occasional wanton youth who is bold enough to stand before it or upon her. By instilling perpetual fear in their weak hearts and toying with their sense of reality, eventually driving them mad. Others still say Black Aggie was a portal to hell and that she was a guide of sorts stationed there to lead souls astray and into the gaping maw of the underworld. And there's yet another story about Black Aggie, one that has to do with her predecessor, the profound statue of grief. Some say that residing within Black Maggie is the ghost of Marian Adams, tethered to this earth by her own pain and suffering. And now that the memorial her husband had custom made for her has been stolen and cheaply replicated without his consent, she is also chained to this realm by her indignant anger. They say she targeted the kids that came to her as a part of some garish fraternity hazing ritual or a midnight game of truth or dare, partially because she wanted to punish them for the misdeeds of Edward Ludwig Ponch and General Felix Angus. She resented how the thrill-seeking teenagers made a mockery of the dead surrounding them and a game out of someone else's mourning, how they cheapened a grave by seeing it as their own place to do whatever they should like on it, just as the general and the sculptor did with Marion's gravesite back at the Rock Creek Cemetery in Washington. But more than that, by haunting the Agnes family memorial, the spirit of Marion Adams ensured that General Felix Angus's resting place would meet the same unfortunate fate as hers did in 1891, by not becoming a resting place at all. It became instead a tourist attraction, a macabre mini-amusement park, a place for visitors to gawk and stare and stomp on his grave, a must-see tourist attraction. Eventually, the stampede of daring teenagers visiting Black Aggie and vandalizing the statue in the middle of the dark nights became too much for the remaining members of the Agnes family, and they donated the statue to the Smithsonian American Art Museum in D.C. The museum accepted their offer, but soon after refused to put the statue on display due to it being an unauthorized replica. Instead, they hid it away in storage for 20 years. Then in 1987, the statue was moved to the courtyard of the National Courts Building in D.C.'s Lafayette Square. In her final resting place, there have been no reports of Black Aggie tormenting any living souls or harassing any teenage visitors. She seems to be finally at peace. But back in the Druid Ridge Cemetery, at the blank stone pedestal that she once occupied, her presence allegedly still lingers. Reports of the sickening, painful atmosphere of the barren, undecorated Agnes family memorial and claims of paranormal happenings flickering all around the gravesite still appear regularly online, and are a common topic of hushed conversations amongst locals. Whether or not these stories are simply stories, or something more, we may never know, but one thing is for certain. It's been almost 100 years since a general died on Halloween night in 1925, but the grass still will not grow on his grave, where Black Aggie used to sit.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that you give me a really nice memorial statue.
Yeah, you want a statue?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I want a statue too. Sounds cool. Do you want to see the statue?
Could be pretty great. What did I recently ask for? Oh, we were watching Shogun, and they do this like beautiful ceremony. I don't know if like it's just tradition in Japanese culture or what, but they take your dead body and they put it in that little like hut thing that they carry.
Oh, yeah.
I have no idea what it's called. And then they all like stand around and mourn and honor while you're essentially incinerated.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they burn the whole thing, the little hut thingy that you're being carried on and everything. And I just thought it would be really cool if like a lot of people hung out and just mourned me all together.
Okay.
I've got a lot of death wishes. Yeah. Photos?
Yes. This first one's an up-close shot of the statue Grief at the Adams Memorial in D.C.
Oh, I don't know what I was thinking it was going to look like, but that is not it.
Here's another pic of it from further back from 1974.
Okay.
So you can see where you can sit on her lap.
Yeah, that makes more sense now.
And then finally, a head-on full shot of the Adams Memorial. I mean, it's cool looking.
Well, the eyes are real creepy in this photo.
Uh-huh.
They just stand out a little bit too much.
And it's that dark gray, reminds like pewter or something, but it's like, yeah, it's a creepy looking statue for sure.
I didn't think it was creepy until that last photo.
Okay.
Just the like the thin, narrow face, and then it just looked like the eyes, they just look very white in comparison
to
the rest of the statue.
And then I have one more. This is Marion Clover Adams from the 1860s. It's just an odd picture where you can't see her face.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but just like the way like this picture was taken, the shadows and stuff around the edges, it reminds me of like a horror movie where I'm waiting for her to turn and there's something very wrong with her face.
Yes.
I feel like she's about ready to take that dog and get on a bike and run away.
Oh, she Dorothy? Funny.
Yeah. She told him Toto.
Oh, yeah. That's a little Toto-esque dog.
Totally. Yeah, that is a weird photo.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like how her...
Do you have any idea what year that photo was taken?
1860s.
That makes it even more weird because it's not like a...
No, they're usually like straight on.
Yeah.
Not smiling, had to hold still. And apparently didn't want that kind of photo taken.
I know, that feels very strange.
Yeah.
Maybe she looks a lot like Black Aggie.
Maybe.
That would be so creepy. Ugh, no. I was thinking something else, but now I can't remember. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Well.
Oh, I was thinking, I'm probably, like, you found, like, that statue so unsettling.
Oh, yeah, because I'm not used to, like, cemetery statues like you are.
That's what I was thinking. Like, growing up in the church, there are so many statues in our church.
Yeah.
There's, like, Joseph and Mary.
Yeah.
And then, like, this huge cross with a very lifelike Jesus on it. And then lots of other little miniature statues around the church. And then, yeah, our cemeteries had, like, huge headstones and often very ornate. There was the Rich Cemetery where my family's not buried, but man, my cousin was buried there, and like it's pretty wild what people will invest in as a headstone or a monument. Yep.
Yeah, we didn't have that stuff. The churches around where I grew up didn't have all that satanic idolatry that like, you know, you grew up around.
Whoa.
And so it was just much more like modest and godly. But that's just, that's just where I grew up. Just like, you know, I wasn't around all that Catholic satan. I guess. You know what's funny is like, I was told that growing up. Like, oh yeah. Like all the like statues and stuff in Catholic churches, totally satanic.
I was, before you said that, I was going to chime in with a, is that like, how it is at finishing school?
You learn about the idolatry. But we really didn't have it. Like the churches didn't have statues at all. None of them. Well, maybe there is a Catholic church, but it's like, I don't remember talking to anybody who ever went to it. They didn't even have a Sunday mass. It was just like the priest from the next town over would come for, I think, a Saturday mass.
Yeah, Saturday after 4 p.m. counts for Sunday.
Okay, yeah. And I don't think it had probably many attendees. And then the other ones, no statues. And then the cemetery, no statues, not a single one.
Well, it could be also just a result of poor rural area.
Totally.
Like hard to get things there.
Yeah.
You know, and then expensive.
Expensive, I think they had the big one.
Yeah.
And just probably like a local culture of just being a little bit more humble. I think people would feel weird for the most part to have, because there's like all these.
You have giant statues in the Riggins Cemetery.
It would stand out so much. I wonder if
they
even have an ordinance.
Your mom would be so annoyed with us.
Well, she'll be hopefully long gone by the time we're dead.
Oh, she'll haunt. She'll find us in the afterlife and be like, what have you done? I'm so embarrassed.
I don't know why I had to add long gone. Like she needs to die a long time before, but hopefully.
Well, honestly.
Hopefully she'll live a long time and then we'll live a long time.
Yeah, your mom's what, 67?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so hopefully she lives for another like 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 5 or 6, but yeah.
Oh, ouch. I'm telling your mom on you.
No, yeah, exactly.
We're having lunch with her in less than an hour and I am ratting you out. But yeah, hopefully she lives for like another 20, 30 and hopefully we live for like another 50, 60.
Okay. All right.
Well, that would make me 90. I'm young and spry.
All right. I don't know if I want to live 60. That puts me well above 100.
Well,
That sounds. We'll see. We'll see what kind of tech.
You probably won't. You're too busy eating steaks and drinking milkshakes.
Oh yeah, and I'll be a robot by then. Okay, you ready for some Cherokee folklore?
Totes my goats.
Okay, that many still today believe is much more than folklore. Before we move on to more scares, we need to take a quick in-between story sponsor break.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What are the things that weigh you down on a day-to-day basis? What kind of stress are you holding on to? Do you spend much of your day going over things in your brain over and over until they are so distracting it affects your mental health? Well, don't worry. You're not alone.
We all carry different stressors, some big, some small. When we keep things bottled up, the results can be negative. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest without fear or judgment. It's a place to work through what is heavy on your mind and heart so that you can feel lighter and happier.
I'm always holding on to something. It's the way my anxious brain works. I'm continually worried that I've done something wrong, that I've hurt the feelings of someone I love, and that I have let someone down. I'm stressed that I'm not being a good enough mom or wife. I panic that our life will implode at any given moment and it'll all be my fault. Thankfully, I have an amazing therapist who helps me talk through each of these scenarios. After each and every appointment, I feel lighter, happier, and more capable of showing up as my most authentic self.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/scaredtodeath today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/scaredtodeath.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Summer is just around the corner. Who's excited? I know I am. With the warmer, sunnier days calling your name, the last place you're going to want to be is in your kitchen, cooking and meal prepping. Make your life easier with Factor's no prep, no mess meals.
Factor's never frozen, always fresh meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Think of all the extra time you will get outside in the summer sun when you aren't wasting hours in the kitchen.
I think I speak for everyone when I say that the summer is the busiest time of the year. We are all trying to cram in as many things as possible, from concerts to vacations and everything in between. With Kyler home from college and Monroe on her break too, I want to spend as much time as possible with them. And while I truly love to cook, the summer is the one time of year that I'm the least interested in doing that for 3 meals a day. So I lean on Factor to help keep me healthy and in step with my diet. I'm obsessed with the honey yogurt pancakes for breakfast, the pork al pastor for lunch, and the cilantro lime barramundi for dinner. So easy and saves me so much time.
Head to factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 and use code scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code scaredtodeath50 at factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Thanks for listening to our sponsor deals, Creeps and Peepers. You help keep this show sponsored, and that is very much appreciated.
Go you.
Jumping right into the story that I find, a lot more interesting than I do scary, as I do with most folklore. Time now for the tale of the Yunwi Junsti. Hickory Nut Gorge, located near Asheville, North Carolina, is a 14-mile-long canyon that cuts a picturesque pass as deep as 1,800 feet through the Blue Ridge Mountains. Abundant and undisturbed forests, waterfalls, and granite cliffs, the gorge used to be home to many Catawba and Cherokee people and was part of an important trade route, mainly based around tobacco that followed the river. The gorge, due to its scenic beauty, started to become popular with tourists back in the 19th century. And tales of various ghostly encounters or paranormal sightings began to emerge almost immediately, with the most famous of these tales centering around supposed sightings of the Yunwi Junsti, a.k.a. the Little People. Some say they were originally called the Moon People because they only came out at night. Others say that the Moon People are a different entity altogether from Cherokee folklore. The gorge was one of the few gaps in the mountains that allowed settlers to pass through on their way to Tennessee and further west, and a common belief was that the gorge was formed by a massive earthquake. According to local Cherokee legends, almost all of the Yunwi Junsti, the Little People, disappeared during this earthquake, possibly killed, possibly returning deep into the earth from whence they may have come. Ethnographer James Mooney, author of Myths of the Cherokees, who lived with the Cherokees for many years and studied their legends, collected different accounts of what or who these creatures are. James Mooney spoke with a chief who told him about the Cherokees' interactions with the Little People. The chief said that most Yunwi Junsti prefer to make their homes in rock caves on the sides of mountains, that they are so small they barely come up to knee height, and they have long black hair that almost touches the ground. The Yunwi Junsti are divided into three different clans, the Laurel People, said to spend half their time drumming and dancing, a fun-loving group who enjoy being pranksters and playing tricks on humans, such as tripping them by making tree roots move beneath their feet, or magically suddenly making rocks appear in front of their feet, and so on. Then there is the Dogwood People, a kind and helpful bunch. Whenever someone becomes lost in the mountains, especially a child who has wandered away from their parents, the Dogwood clan will do what they can to find them and return them home safely. They've also been said to harvest corn at night when the human owner of the cornfield is too ill or injured to harvest it themselves.
Sure.
Helpful little corn harvesters.
I like it.
Sometimes the drums of the Dogwood Yunwi Junsti can be heard at night, but it isn't safe or wise to follow the sound and search for them. They often don't want to be found and will hide, causing those who search for them to get turned around and lost in the woods. Not only can you reportedly sometimes hear the Little People's drums in the mountains at night, some have claimed to hear their voices talking at night as well, and not way out in the woods all the time or high up in rocky cliffs, but near their houses. The Yunwi Junsti almost never come out during the day, but can appear anywhere at night, way out in the woods, or even inside your home. The third clan of the Little People are the Rock People, and they are not known for being kind and friendly. They don't like humans for the most part, and do not like being disturbed. When they are disturbed, they're said to be able to cast a spell on you, a spell that can cause disorientation and confusion. The person under influence of this spell, even if they make it back home, will often still seem lost, as if they're stuck in a trance, one they may never recover from. According to old legends about these Rock People, if out in the woods and a Cherokee warrior were to find an object they felt was useful, like a knife or a grinding stone, they had to ask permission of these beings before taking it. They were told to hold the object in their hand and say, "Yunwi Junsti, I want to take this." And if they heard nothing back, the object was theirs to keep. If the Rock People refused, they would let this person know by pelting them with stones until they dropped the object and left the area. The following description of the Little People comes from History, Myths, and Sacred Formulas of the Cherokees by that ethnographer, James Mooney, who wrote all this between 1891 and 1902. "There is another race of spirits who live in rock caves on the mountainside. They are little fellows, hardly reaching up to a man's knee, but well-shaped and handsome, with hair long and falling to the ground. They are great wonder workers and are very fond of music, spending half their time drumming and dancing. They are helpful and kind-hearted, and often when people have been lost in the mountains, especially children who have strayed away from their parents, the Little People have found them and taken them back to their homes. The Little People do not like to be disturbed at home, and they throw a spell over the stranger so that he is bewildered and loses his way. According to legends based around the Hickory Nut Gorge, these beings could also be fierce. They were guardians of what the Cherokee called the sacred tobacco, which grew near the gorge, and the Yunwijunsti took harsh actions against anyone trespassing into their territory in the gorge in search of it. Per Cherokee origin mythology, in the beginning of the world, there was once a single tobacco plant for all creatures, but it was stolen by geese and swiftly carried to a place far away in the south. And now, without the power of the tobacco, Cherokee men grew weak and death was imminent. But then somehow, the Yunwijunsti were able to grow new tobacco in the Hickory Nut Gorge. Swift warriors and powerful shamans were sent into the gorge to find this sacred medicine, but they were crushed by boulders, toppled by the little people. The strong winds blowing through the stone hollow would then sometimes throw the braves who came next into the turbulent waters of the river, and they would be washed away, never to be seen again. According to another old legend, the legend of the little people in Hickory Nut Gorge, several leaders held a meeting many, many years ago to discuss how best to pass through the gap. A young man volunteered to make the journey, eager to prove his bravery, and he was never seen again. When the Cherokee needed to obtain more tobacco, the elders met again for a meeting. This time, a magician offered to make the journey. He turned himself into a mole. He almost made it through the gap, but the little people found him and chased him out. He was forced to flee without any tobacco. The magician now transformed into a hummingbird and returned, but he couldn't carry much tobacco in that form. During his third attempt, the magician transformed into a whirlwind. He tore through the gap, ripping up trees and shrubs and sending large boulders flying. The whirlwind exposed rock cliffs that are still there today. The little people fled the area after this whirlwind passed through, and the magician found the lost warrior's bones in the river and brought him back to life. Ever since then, now that the little people had fled the gorge, or at least most of them had, the Cherokee were able to move through the area freely and get their precious tobacco. Interesting folklore. Could it be based on anything real? There have been strange paranormal encounters of beings some think are the little people over the years. In July of 1806, a group of witnesses claimed to witness a group of spectral beings flying through the air. The following is their account, which was published under the title of Phantom Armies Out of Time, written by Vincent Gaddis for the Journal of Borderland Research. A number of witnesses watched a crowd of literally hundreds of beings resembling humans as they passed through the atmosphere in a long procession. Many were the size of infants, all clad in brilliant white raiment. Rising up into view from the side of the mountain, with most of the mountaintop visible above them, the figures moved to the north and gathered around Chimney Rock. When all but a few had reached the rock, several of the glittering white forms rose above the others, who then began circling the rock at about the rock's height. A few minutes later, the figures that had risen moved to a point about 20 yards from the rock's summit. They were followed by the rest in a procession, and at that point, one by one, they vanished. According to an affidavit signed by the observers, the disappearance left a solemn and pleasing impression on the mind, accompanied with a diminution of bodily strength. The vision lasted for about an hour. The next account comes from a minister and his friend who claimed he was one of the witnesses to this event. This account was written in The Haunted South by Nancy Roberts. On July 31st, 1806, a Presbyterian minister was sitting at his desk at Newton Academy, preparing lessons for the next day. The minister became so lost in his work that the time got away from him, and before he knew it, it was dark out. He was gathering his papers when a loud bang pounded against the door, startling him. The knocking continued in a very agitated manner as the minister ran through the dark corridor to open up the doors. In rushed a friend of his named Robert Searcy. He was clearly panicked. The minister had never seen his friend this way. He was pale and shaking, his eyes wild. He said, "I don't know how to tell you what I've just seen. You may not even believe me, but I saw them with my own eyes. They were on the mountain. They were near the rock. They were everywhere. May I come in and sit down?" The minister urged him to sit down and asked his friend to describe what he had seen. Searcy told the minister, "Well, no matter how I tell you about this, it is going to sound like I have lost my mind. But probably the best thing for me to do is start at the beginning." Searcy told the minister how he had been sitting on his porch, winding down after an early supper, when the young daughter of his, neighbor, Mrs. Reeves, ran up to him in a state of incredible excitement. The young girl grabbed his hand and told him he must come with them at once, and that they had seen people flying on the side of the mountain. At first, Searcy said he dismissed it as some childish prank, but then Mrs. Reeves came and asked him to come see the ghosties. Searcy could tell that she was upset and decided to go with her to calm them down. Mrs. Reeves took him towards the mountain and asked Searcy, "Do you see them?" Searcy at this point said he saw nothing. But then, as they continued walking, Mrs. Reeves suddenly grabbed his arm, exclaiming, "There they are! Look! Over there!" Cersei told the minister, "This time I looked toward the chimney. I was absolutely amazed, for south of Chimney Rock, and floating along the side of the mountain, was a huge crowd of white phantom-like beings. Their clothing, and as flimsy as it looked, I can only call it clothing, was so brilliant a white it almost hurt my eyes to look at them. But they appeared to be human, all sizes of beings, even infants. As I watched, two of them who appeared to be men went on ahead of the crowd, coming quite close to the rock and then vanished." Cersei said that seeing the flying people left a solemn and pleasing impression on my mind, but he was worried that he had gone insane. The minister sat back in his chair, quite shocked, but after a minute of thinking to himself, declared, "You are not crazy at all. You have simply seen a sight that only a few people have ever been privileged to witness, a sight so spectacular that stories about it have been told for generations among the Cherokee Indians." The minister explained the history of the land and how the gorge was used as a passageway to find tobacco, but the passage was guarded by the little people. He told Cersei that he didn't believe what he saw was a mirage. The minister said he wasn't quite sure if they were angels or spirits. The little people were also reportedly seen in 1811 by a great number of people again. So large was the crowd that some compared it to a battle, with swords flashing. Were these people perhaps witnessing the ghosts of the Yunwei Junsti? In 1895, two hunters in Hickory Nut Gorge went behind a waterfall, and they claimed to enter a cave where they found fresh footprints of the Yunwei Junsti. About 30 miles from that cave, roughly 40 years later, construction began in some new buildings for Western Carolina University. A man named Walter Middleton worked on this project, and years later, he would talk with Mary Joyce about some mysteries uncovered there, and Mary would write a book called Cherokee Little People Were Real. Joyce said that during the construction, Walter and his co-workers found skeletons and a small child-sized skull, a skull that one of the science professors at Western Carolina would keep on his desk, almost like a decorative paperweight. Eventually, another professor started asking him questions about it, and when he was told it was a child's skull, he said, "No, it isn't. It has all its wisdom teeth. This is an adult." Joyce also said that Middleton and his fellow construction workers said they found tunnels, small, obviously man-made tunnels, carved through red clay, but tunnels only big enough for a person not much bigger than a small child to travel through. Did these tunnels connect to nearby cave systems? Sadly, the construction of some of the school's new buildings destroyed most of whatever kind of archaeological site this was. Here's another strange Yunwei Junsti story, a much more recent one. In 1990, a woman went to drop by the home of a Cherokee man she was dating out in the Hickory Gorge area, a man who lived alone, and whose home was not near any of his neighbors. She didn't call before she came over. She wanted to surprise him. When he wasn't there, she left and returned home. When she next saw him, he said that he was sorry that he wasn't home when she stopped by before she brought it up. When she asked him how he could know that she had come over, he smiled and told her that the little people watch over his house while he's away, and they had told him that she had been by. They even described exactly what she wore. Finally, you can start poking around on the internet, or if you start poking around, you'll find dozens of blog posts and videos of people claiming to either encounter these entities in recent years, not just in North Carolina, but all over North America, or to know someone who has encountered them. And in the comments underneath these videos, collectively, hundreds of more people are claiming the same. What are these Yunwei Junsti? What are these entities known by many other names in the folklore of many other tribes? Does anyone ever really see them or really hear them? Is it all in people's imaginations? Or is there somehow a race or several races of small mythical beings who somehow continue to avoid scientific confirmation of their existence year after year, decade after decade, century after century?
They're just little fairies.
Yeah, like little, I know, it is interesting that there's like fairy and elf mythology like all over the world.
Little gnomes?
Mm-hmm, yep.
I know, I like it. They sound really sweet.
Yeah, they don't sound too scary for the most part.
No, I would be happy to see one of them. I can't say what they are. How do you say it?
It is Yunwei Junsti.
Yeah, that. I cannot wrap my head around. Well, how is that spelled?
It's spelled, well, Yunwei is spelled, it's Y-U-N-W-I.
Okay,
Yunwei. And then Junsti, and I looked up several videos from like Cherokee, the people making the videos were Cherokee.
Yeah.
And they said it's Yunwei. But it's T-S-U-N-S-D-I.
Oh, okay. My brain cannot accept it because it just doesn't sound like it's an unfamiliar word. So I'm like, what is this? I need to see it written down.
I have two photos.
Okay.
First one is just a pretty photo of Hickory Nut Gorge at sunset.
Oh my God, that's gorgeous.
Yeah, there's that little river and the little canyon below. Yeah, really pretty.
My God, so pretty.
I could not find a good illustration of the Unweedunsi, but I did find this old photo of Tom Cruise standing next to his ex-wife, Katie Holmes.
Oh my God.
Who looks like she's about 2 or 3 feet taller than him.
What? That has got to be a distorted photo. What is happening there?
Well,
wait, explain to me how you got to this photo.
I Googled Tom Cruise tiny man.
Oh, okay. Because mm-hmm. I was like, how do you go from Uwe Junsti to that? I should have said
I just Googled Uwe Junsti and this came up. Because, you know, maybe Tom Cruise is one of these mythical beings.
Do you
have a guess on his height?
If I had to guess, I think he's about 2'6". No, he's I looked up, he's supposedly 5'6", but I don't buy
it. He's not.
What do you think, Logan?
That's about what I was. I looked it up on Google, and it said he's listed as 5'7".
Yeah, there's no way.
I don't buy it either.
What do you think, Lindsay?
Okay, my experience is that he's about 5'5".
Okay, so close.
Because if this is not an altered photo, Katie Holmes is 5'9".
Exactly.
So you do the math. Right.
Oh my God. Yeah, I was gonna say she's a tall woman, but she's not 6 feet tall.
The resolution wasn't good. I was going to include it, but somebody clearly altered a photo of Tom Cruise standing next to Cameron Diaz on like a red carpet.
But she's really tall.
She is tall, but she looks like she's a good 3 feet taller than him in that photo.
Oh, he's 3 feet. She's 6 feet. Seems right.
Like she's like his son.
Okay. When I was working at Universal on, I think it was during Desperate Housewives, he was filming. Oh, God, this isn't going to help. I'm going to describe it, and you're going to say that's every Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah.
It's like him riding a motorcycle through like what was supposed to be like Pompeii or like the running of the bulls. That's what it was.
I haven't watched the Mission Impossible movies. Maybe one of those.
Exactly. Well, no, I'm saying like even if I described it, you'll never guess it because it's like all of it. It could be any of his movies, any of his action films. And he is on a motorcycle. And I just remember looking down from the, and I was like, he is tiny.
He's a little fella.
And I mean, obviously I'm looking from like, you know, the 10th floor, but other people looked significantly larger than him from that distance.
Look what his Napoleon complex has accomplished.
I know.
Pushed him to greater heights, no pun intended, than he ever. Yeah.
Rumor has it he is lovely to the staff and the crew.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like bringing in like coffee trucks and food trucks.
That's cool.
And like, because a lot of times when you're on a film set, TV too, but more film, You have only a certain amount of time to shoot. It's not like an ongoing, like with a TV show, you can push production like a couple weeks sometimes. But you'll work and you'll have second dinner, second meal.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's like the 15th, 16th, 17th hour.
Oh, my God.
And they're like, okay. And so Tom, I guess, is notorious for like bringing in a coffee truck or like a dessert truck or like when Cool House, when those ice cream sandwiches were really big.
Yeah.
Or people would like, I mean, I've worked with other people who've brought stuff in, but I never worked with Tom.
But you heard good things. That's great
really
to hear.
Really good things.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm surprised by that. I expected him to be some crazy diva.
Well, I think because ever since the Oprah interview, people just associate him with being crazy and just being like, you know, really big personality.
Yeah, but that's not.
I mean, maybe, but at least he's nice about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that actually is interesting where it's like, you know, one moment of his long life, a very successful life, gets like, you know, to define him. He's done all these movies and all these things. And then people just think like Scientology and they think like jumping on the couch.
Yeah.
That reminds me of, there was this presidential candidate years ago. I believe his name was Howard Dean.
Like Jimmy Dean?
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
Okay, look, with the scream?
Yeah.
Right, this poor guy, I don't remember his platform. I don't even remember what party he belonged to. I just remember, I have a vague memory of his campaign going pretty well. Whatever party he was going, presidential campaign is going pretty well. Seemed like a decent guy, and he just was at a rally. You know, he's excited. His people are cheering.
Too many woos.
Yeah. Well, he just goes woo, just like does this yell. But
we're gonna go to Ohio. We're gonna go to New Hampshire. We're gonna go to Florida.
Yeah. Oh my God. Good memory. Yeah. But the way the mic picked it up, it distorted it. And it made him sound like a maniac.
Like his demonic-y or?
No, just like cartoonish. Like this weird like, squeal.
I would love it if our president squealed like that. But it would fill me with joy.
But then they just kept replaying that clip over and over. And it was like that single moment ruined his campaign and turned him into a laughingstock.
I will say like,
if I'm remembering this correctly.
We'll dive into the stories.
Yeah.
Just a tiny little breather here. you and I have talked over the years, just like with the things that we've come up against, as just like, we are not famous. Like, yeah. You know, like, so like C, D, E level, like so aware of that.
Yeah.
But even just like in our little ecosystem mm-hmm. of like how like one thing that you do one time and then people talk about, and it's like, we've talked about just like with some drama that has happened over the years.
Yeah.
It's like, I do have a different level of empathy and sympathy for celebrities of like, man, maybe you caught them on a bad day. Maybe,
totally.
Maybe they just, there's like some famous story about Julia Roberts pulling over on the way to taking her kids to school, pulling over, getting out of the car and just going off on paparazzi. Like, fucking let me take my kids to fucking school.
Right.
You want me? Get me later. Leave my kids alone.
Yeah.
And I just, But then it's like, then she gets a reputation for being a fucking asshole.
Which is great. Yeah. Paparazzi are some of my least favorite people on earth.
Yeah.
And I, every time, without exception, whenever I hear about a paparazzi member getting punched in the face.
Oh, I applaud it.
Oh, I love it. I'm
who
like,
was that recently?
Sean Penn years ago punched. I was like, yes.
Just recently, was it Ryan Reynolds or?
Ooh, I would love it if Ryan Reynolds punched a.
I don't think it was him, but he was like it's a celebrity who lives in New York and he was driving. I think he parked his car and got out and just socked somebody.
Love it.
I was like, yeah, that's what you get. Fucking leave him alone. Like, did we not learn anything from Princess Diana?
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, led to her death. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well,
vultures.
Vulture.
Parasites.
All right. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed our intermission. all right, let's dive into three back-to-back haunted house stories.
Okay.
Who's your Layla?
I wasn't thinking how it, I got my yellow Layla. T-shirt. I got my yellow Layla.
Matches the yellow dino nugget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm feeling yellow today.
I feel like a dino nugget. That sounds so good. I'm so hungry right now. I moved to a small town in Massachusetts at the end of the fourth grade. I didn't like the idea of leaving my friends behind. We moved into a nice home on the smaller side, but enough room for our 5-person family. The realtor told my parents there was, quote, history to this house, but me, being a kid, I never fully understood. The house had an odd shape with secret passageways in the closets that connected the rooms. As a kid, I loved this. By middle school, my parents trusted me to be home alone until they were back from work. During the day, I would play Xbox and watch TV. I always had the feeling that someone was there with me, behind me, watching. I would forget this feeling until I went to bed. I had horrible dreams and night terrors, always of the crawl spaces in the closets and that someone was in there, watching, lurking. On a particular day, my parents left me home alone. They had plans to not be back until 9 or 9:30 that night. I knew I had to hold my own and show them I was a responsible kid. I wouldn't know that tonight I wouldn't be the only one in the house. It was growing later and darker with the clock showing 7:30 p.m. I only had a few hours to go. I was sitting on the couch watching a movie when a sudden noise surprised me. The basement door had swung open hard and the atmosphere of the house changed instantly. Heavy, suppressant energy filled the house. From upstairs, I heard the creaking of our old steps followed by the sounds of feet running pitter-patter, pitter-patter, pitter-patter. I began to make my way upstairs. I had to check things out. And as I did, all I could see was a tall, slender man bolt into one of our crawl spaces. I did not follow him. I am not a Darren. I ran downstairs, but I could feel him running behind me. And as soon as I set my foot on the bottom step and looked over my shoulder, he was gone. I took a deep breath of relief and called my mom, sharing with her everything that had just happened. And what do you think she said? That I must be crazy. It's just my imagination. And that I was only to call her for real emergencies. All the adrenaline must have made me hungry. I started to rummage through the cupboards and realized that we were out of most of the things and that the back stock was in the basement. Reluctantly, I headed downstairs. As I was searching for something to eat, I heard a whisper behind my ear, "Behind you." I ran as fast as my feet would take me up the stairs and straight outside. I didn't care that it was getting dark. I felt safer out there than in my own house. I tried to distract myself by playing soccer when I accidentally kicked my ball into a small corner of the yard where the grass always refused to grow. As I bent down to pick up my ball, I saw something that still traumatizes me to this day. A human finger. A child-sized finger. Or at least what was left of one. I wasted no time and immediately called the police and then called my mom. This was a real emergency. My mom arrived just in time to watch the police begin digging. What they found was horrifying. The bodies of an adult female and two young females. After this incident, I did some research on my home. As it turns out, a family had lived there before the owners we bought the house from. A dad, who was a butcher, and a stay-at-home mom and their two daughters. The dad went utterly insane and in the darkness of night, brutally killed his daughters and wife. He hacked them up and buried them on our property, and then he killed himself. I never felt safe in my home ever again, as I always felt the father's hushed whisper in my ear, "Behind you." Can you fucking imagine
finding that out, or finding seeing a finger?
Like, as an adult, I would lose my mind. Being like, what, this is like a fourth grader? Mm-hmm. Were you like 13, 12? I would lose my ever-loving shit.
Yeah.
A human finger.
Ugh. I know. I can't imagine. I mean, yeah, seeing that now would be so just jarring. Like, you know, finding that. But like, as a kid, oh my gosh.
Because it's not like you accidentally dug up somebody's dog that died that they buried in their backyard.
Right, right, right.
This is...
yeah, human bodies. And then also just like, nothing to do with the horror, but the secret passageways connecting the closets.
Also don't like that.
I would have loved that as a kid.
As a kid?
Yeah.
And until you're old enough to like have the conscious thoughts of like, that's creepy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do like secret stuff in a house. So it's like, I mean, okay, like if we just had some, okay, crazy $100 million.
Okay, that sounds great.
And you can have like whatever kind of house you want.
Okay.
I would love, I think it'd be fun to have like a little compound of houses.
Uh-huh.
So when your friends come over, they can have like their little standalone spot.
Uh-huh.
And then I would want them connected by tunnels underground. And I would want to have like secret like library, like maybe not that one because that's obvious, like you pulled a book.
Yeah.
But a version of that where there's secret walls, they go into rooms. Sure. I mean, it'd just be so fun.
Kind of.
Be like, I don't know, be interesting conversation starters.
Yeah, but then when you're home alone in that house and you hear a noise, you hear something fall within those passageways.
Ooh, yeah.
You're not going to be doing well. I was restraining my laughter because I was reflecting on a recent dinner that we had with Monroe where we were convincing her to just like not go to college and live with us forever.
Oh, yeah.
And then we were going to have like, you know, we were going to bulldoze our house and build two houses on our property. And Monroe was going to live in one, but she was always going to sleep in our house. She would just like go to her house during the day.
Yeah,
I think that was the plan.
That was the plan. Yeah, just to get a little space.
Yeah.
No, I was trying to sell her on just living in the basement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Momo.
She can play as many games as she wants.
Totally.
Yeah, no rent.
With the last kid at home, we're really like pulling at straws. We're like, stay forever. We love you.
And not really. We're pushing her, but it's fun to joke that we wanted to stay forever. I mean, if she stayed, maybe we could just live houses next door to each other.
I like it. I know I offered her a tunnel and she said, no, thanks. Okay. Moving on to another haunted house with disbelieving parents. When I was 5 years old, my parents divorced while my dad was in prison. When my dad got out of prison, he went to live with my aunt, his sister. We would spend the weekend with my dad and my aunt as my mom still wanted us to have our other family in our lives despite the divorce and the jail time. I remember going over to my aunt's house for the first time to see my dad. When we saw him, of course we were excited. The first time seeing our dad in 2 years, we couldn't wait. With me was my sister and two brothers. When we got to the house, my aunt said flat out, "If you hear any other kids or footsteps upstairs, just ignore them like we do."
What?
As kids, we didn't think much of it. But when I walked to the bottom of the stairs, I suddenly didn't want to go up them. Something was up there. I could feel it, and it was scary. I begged my dad not to have to sleep upstairs. He caved, and our first few weekends together, we all camped out in the living room. Us four kids and our dad. Eventually, my brothers and sister felt safe enough to sleep upstairs, but I still refused. After 2 months of my refusal to sleep upstairs, my dad said his back just couldn't take the couch anymore, even just for a weekend. It was time for me to sleep in the room my sister and I were meant to share and see that it wasn't scary. My aunt even put a nightlight in the hallway to keep me calm, and for good measure, we kept the door open. The first night, I couldn't sleep, tossing and turning and just scared out of my mind. My sister and I shared a bed. She faced the door while I faced the wall where the dresser with a clock on it sat. It flashed 3:15 a.m. in red lights. Maybe the lights were keeping me up. I rolled over and faced my sister, playing with her hair to pass time. I heard footsteps coming down the hall, and I saw a light through the crack of our door open, getting brighter and closer. I assumed it was my aunt or my dad checking in on us kids, so I pretended to be asleep to avoid getting in trouble. The light stopped just shy of our door and held steady there, not moving into our room or away from our room. I could only fake being asleep for so long before I looked towards the light. And there, in our doorway, was a little girl. My heart stopped in my chest as I buried my face in my sister's back. She was my bigger, older sister. Surely she would protect me. The light began to glow brighter until it illuminated our room. Heart pounding, too scared to scream, I felt her hand touch my arm. The little girl then burst into flames and screamed, "Come to hell with me."
Jeez.
I screamed so loudly, I woke my sister and my dad and my aunt, hot on his heels, and my two brothers close behind her. My sister was trying to calm me as my dad sat next to me on the bed. I could not stop screaming and crying. Every time I'd take a deep inhale, only a scream came out as an exhale. Eventually, I was able to gather myself enough to tell them what had happened. Naturally, they didn't believe me. After all, I was just a 5-year-old who had had a nightmare. This same series of events went on for 4 weekends in a row. I'd beg not to sleep upstairs, but be forced to. A light in the hallway would make its way to my room. The little girl would grab me, scream at me, and then I'd wake up the whole house with my screaming and crying. On the last night I'd spend upstairs, my dad finally believed me. When he came into my room, as he did every night, he found a handprint on my arm. It was covered in ash and was a perfect shape. It was not the handprint of a little girl, though. It was the size of an adult. My aunt was convinced that the demon was disguising itself as a little girl. 23 years old, and I still see her to this day. She just lingers behind me, waiting for I don't know what. Maybe to take me to hell. Katie.
Yee, Katie.
Yee, yee, yee. I don't like it.
I don't know. I don't know why this thought popped in my head. But, you know, I mean, obviously that would be terrifying to see a little girl's apparition burst into flames.
Awful.
As it yells, like, you know, come to hell with me.
Oh my God.
But then... I can't remember the main guy from I Think You Should Leave.
Oh,
I can never remember his
name. Tim Robinson.
Thank you.
I can never remember his name.
Tim Robinson. my mind turned all of that into an I Think You Should Leave sketch where this little, like, but Tim Robinson is the guy living in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And a little girl, like, you know, burst into flames, you know, come to hell with me. And he's like, yeah, right. The hell sucks. No way. That's crazy. And just like laughs it off. Like how frustrated as a demon you would be if like you're just not scaring this person at all. And they're just taking your request very literally. You're like, no. Yeah, right. I don't know. That's all it was.
I feel like we should find a way to get you on that show and present this to Tim and just be like, what do you think, man? Like, can we do this?
I just do love, like, it would be so tonally disrupting to a horror movie, but just to have like his character that he always plays on that sketch show inserted into like a really good horror movie where like just nothing scares that guy. Just like no matter what the demon does, like all these crazy things. Yeah, get out of here. That's crazy. And then just like goes to the fridge and gets a snack out. Demon's like, come on. That was my best move.
Okay. That would annoy the shit out of me.
It would ruin the movie.
That is, to me, the equivalent of going to a horror movie and like somebody's just in the audience like, oh, stop it.
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's just
putting that person.
It's putting that person in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm sure Kyler's available. You can't watch horror movies with Kyler.
True.
One more?
Yeah, one more.
Ready to revisit the Whaley house?
Yes.
Yes. Let's go. Hey, guys. My story is as phony sounding as a ghost story could possibly be, and I'm painfully aware of that. All I can do is swear that none of this is a lie, and dozens of friends and family members saw what I found, including skeptics and even a cousin who works in special effects. No one had an answer. My family and I went to the Whaley House in Old Town San Diego for a tour when I was 13. My siblings spent most of the ride over excitedly talking about the famous ghost activity, like rope burns by a tree and the sounds of a woman crying at night. I'm a huge skeptic, so although it's a lot of fun to imagine any of this happening, I wasn't expecting anything to actually happen. We took the tour going from room to room as their history and uses were explained to us. There are tons of artifacts and portraits on the walls with little explanations and descriptions, and those quickly became my favorite part of the tour. I'm a massive nerd. As a 13-year-old with my very first brand new cell phone, I recorded everything, just holding it by my head while I looked at pictures and articles. I wasn't watching what I was capturing. I did a sweep of each room like I was making a VR tour for later. We walked through the whole house. The only room I didn't enter was the famous theater room. It was packed with people looking for ghosts, easily the most crowded area by far. It was a stuffy summer day, and there wasn't anything cool on the walls in there, so I waited outside for my family, admiring the hallway. There were two portraits in the hallway, one of the head of the family and one of his son, if I'm remembering correctly. It was by the son's bedroom, but I didn't look in. I was absolutely fascinated by the wall instead. The wallpaper, the photos, the portraits. I spent almost 10 minutes standing in place, not 3 feet from the wall. I studied their expressions and wondered what their lives were like, how they must have felt in the moment they were living out this sad history that I was now hearing about. I was a little tired and mildly bored all by myself in that hallway, but I didn't move, not even to check out other things further down the hall. Instead, I stared at the portraits the entire time. When my family left the theater room and the tour ended, we spent the evening walking around Old Town and then went to a restaurant for dinner to chat about how much fun we'd had. And just as I had expected, nothing spooky happened on that tour. But I was very happy with my experience. It was, all in all, a great day. And that's when I remembered my video. I took out my phone and let it play, laughing with my siblings and teasing them whenever I had caught them on camera. I distinctly remember how warm and inviting the atmosphere was before I reached the recording of that hallway. Because as soon as I saw it, a chill went up my spine. I went completely silent, and the room seemed quieter, emptier. I waited and waited for a logical explanation for what I was seeing, but it never came. I remember every second of the man staring back at me in the video. I watched that video over and over for weeks, made other people watch it over and over for even longer, and it's never faded from my mind. He was black and white, tall, blotchy, with pitch black shadows that took up his eyes, mouth, neck, and chest. Otherwise, he was in perfect clarity, with an unmistakable and solid silhouette. He looked like someone had taken a normal man and turned the contrast up so high the usual shadows you might expect were now so distorted they only implied where features should be. It was almost like someone did that in order to recreate a classic Halloween white sheet ghost in a realistic style. Two black holes for eyes and a dark, wailing shape of a mouth and white everywhere else. He stared at me from that portrait, half his upper body sticking out of the wall and standing over me close enough to touch. He was moving slowly, like he was shifting his weight from one foot to the other, and the shadow moved with him. As time went on, I stayed perfectly still. My phone didn't drift. I had barely moved in that hallway, and he was shifting shadows more and more erratically, rocking back and forth. I chose to believe the dark, dark shadows were drifting with his motion, obscuring his face as he bowed. When they reached his chest, it could have been an old-fashioned collar that warped them. But in a literal sense, they looked as though his gaping mouth grew wider and wider until it spilled down his chest like a much more real, gruesome version of those plastic scream white ghost masks. He was completely silent, rocking and hunching for almost a full minute, faster and faster, but never inhumanely so. The black spots where his eyes were kept raising to meet mine when he bowed lower than my height. I remained his sole focus the entire time, completely alone in the hallway. Finally, he was too low to remain protruding from the portrait and disappeared back into the wall, into the room behind the wall, perhaps. He didn't return, and very soon after, the tour of the theater room concluded and people started pouring back out. I looked online for similar stories and ghost videos and pictures for years afterward, even returned a few months later and asked about the hallway. I never saw nor heard of an experience remotely like mine, and the tour guide had never heard of anything remarkable happening outside of the theater room. You're probably wondering where that video is. Well, here's what happened. I showed that video to everyone, to my little sisters who cried, to my mother, who then told me I used to talk to invisible people on the stairs of their old house as a toddler and hush at graves. I showed the video to my dad, who hates ghost stories, and he told me to stop lying. But after watching the video on loop for 15 minutes, he gave me my phone back and we never spoke about it again. I showed it to my cousins, grandmother, and friends. For a year, I had this video. Unfortunately, I was technologically illiterate due to being homeschooled in a strict household. Health reasons, no religious baggage here. And I couldn't ever figure out how to send the video to anyone. In hindsight, I guess Wi-Fi is kind of important. It lived and died on my phone after my little sister wiped it out on accident. We still talk about that ghost. No one has forgotten or thinks it was a figment of our imaginations. It was real. He stood in front of me and watched me for a long time while I was alone. I don't know why, and I don't know if he's still there, or even who he is. For a while, I was even afraid he'd followed me home, so I never played with a Ouija board, just in case. But I wonder if there's someone else out there who has seen him too.
Mm.
So well, strange.
We'll find out if anybody has seen him. Email us at mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com.
Tell us. That's such a like... I love museums and, you know, mm-hmm. tours of homes or just, you know, anything of the nature. And the thought of just like looking at something and then it like taking a video and then looking at it and it's coming out of the fucking wall.
Uh-huh.
But when I was standing there, I didn't see it. Like mm-hmm. that thing of like something happening around you that you can't feel or see, but then you have proof that it was happening.
Right. Cause then you'd be in your head going forward, wondering, is something happening right now? Is something happening right now?
I think you become really paranoid.
Yeah, I think so too.
Ugh.
I was thinking in the beginning that, they said that that was their first cell phone they got when they were 13 years old. And it just reminded me of...
How old you were when you got your first cell phone?
Well, not as much older. Yeah,
I know.
No, it reminded me of like the kids when their first cell phones.
Uh-huh.
And I think Kyler found like... Well, actually the first was like an iPod, but it had some kind of photo capability. Whatever his first one had photo. God. And then Monroe did the same thing in the last like year. And we, for the first time, saw these photos of Kyler Monroe from when they were like... I think the early ones with Kyler, he's probably like 6, 7. Monroe, yeah, probably like 4.
Just for clarity, they were like old iPods or iPod Touches or old cell phones that we had that were no longer active.
Right,
like, it's not like our 7-year-old had a freaking cell phone.
No, they weren't working phones, but they were some kind of like phone-like device or deactivated phone that had a camera. And I had no idea that they were taking all these selfies. And it's like so funny, like little kid selfies where they don't quite know how the camera works. And so it's like half their face is in the picture.
They're really
or
funny.
They're just like staring. It's like, it's the same type of pictures that my dad will send now. My dad is not technologically savvy at all. And like Monroe will say that when he takes a selfie, it looks like a proof of life photo. Like he's been taken hostage and he's scared. But he's like, wants to show that he's still alive.
Oh, God.
But like the ones of Monroe just killed me of like her, like 4 years old.
Oh, she's so cute.
Trying to look cool or whatever. And just like these weird smiles. And yeah, so funny.
And then like little funny like selfie videos.
Oh, yeah. Singing little songs. Oh, and her and Kyler would do little plays.
Yep. Or like TV shows or act outs.
Mm-hmm. They weren't written. God. It was just one of, it was just both of them kind of playing an improv game together. Where they're like directing each other in this movie that exists in their heads that doesn't match up with each other.
Oh,
it's just
God.
A mess and it's so fun to watch.
Do you remember the Kyler's phase of really being into football and wanting you to like throw him a pass so he could dive?
Mm-hmm.
And then he would do it in the house, like in the basement, like get a video of me diving, get
mm-hmm,
a video.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many videos of him like kind of like sort of backwards jumping over a couch like, Monroe, get this video. No, you didn't do it right.
Yep.
He's screaming at her.
He was really into creating these like NFL highlight type videos.
God.
To the point that he wanted to play football. I'm like, I think we should actually probably work on like real plays.
No.
And yeah, but he just had these images in his head of like, he's going to run this route. And you know, it's a classic little kid thing of the clock's winding down.
Yeah.
This touchdown will win the game.
Totally.
And they have to dive to catch it.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm.
So cute.
So sweet. Just the simplicity of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that desire to like be the winner, be heralded by your teammates.
Yeah. Do you remember Penny Sherman? Penny was-
Oh my God, yes, out in the backyard.
Penny was his primary defender. Like my favorite-
That was really funny.
My favorite phase of this is we're in the yard. Kyler's probably about 12.
Yeah.
And Penny, our little like, you know, 25 pound little Labradoodle or Australian Labradoodle, she would like, you know, want to chase like, you know, balls or whatever like that.
Forgot.
And so she's a really smart dog. And it's like she kind of figured out that Kyler was going to go run to try and catch this ball. And she was going to like chase Kyler.
Uh-huh.
So she became, and Kyler's favorite defender was his cornerback, Richard Sherman,
uh-huh.
with the Seahawks. And his favorite receiver was AJ Green. So,
right.
So he would put the AJ Green jersey on and Penny would be Penny Sherman.
I forgot.
His lockdown defender.
You have to text him after this and remind him. Because I bet he's completely forgotten.
Oh, we talked about it not that long. Actually, when I went and visited him in at school, we threw the football around like last fall when I visited him at college.
Where was I?
It was that one where I went and I played games with him. It was just like...
Oh, the orientation.
Orientation, yeah.
Yeah.
And I went...
It was like before school.
Oh, no. This one was he was settled there. Oh, I was doing shows.
Shows in Rhode Island.
Yeah, I was doing shows in Rhode Island. And we went and we won a football. That's what it was. We bought a bunch of tickets to Dave and Buster's, won a because little Patriots football.
Because you were insane at Dave and Buster's.
I was winning every game.
Sophie sent me a video afterwards of you like winning. And she was like, I am convinced that he went the day before and learned the games and then came back with us.
Yeah, I literally won the game, NFL Gridiron. Like it just, I went to the very end of it.
That's pretty funny.
I had some fast feet that day. But we were throwing that football around out in a park after that. And we're talking about Penny Sherman.
Did he remember?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so sweet. So sweet. It's crazy to think like, you know, that was just, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. Like such a huge jump from him just being like a little guy in the backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Playing with Penny Sherman. And now he's across the country on his own going to college.
Full grown man.
Ah, let's tone it down on the man.
He's a half grown man.
He's a baby adult.
He is a baby adult.
Yeah, but he's doing great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want to do some Annabelle shout outs?
I would love to.
Go for it.
I'd like to thank the following Annabelles for supporting us here with Scared to Death. We appreciate it greatly. Ash J, Amanda Oost, Ashley Taylor, Megan Zentgraf, Jan Stewart, Lexi Lou 312.
Hey, I like that.
Mm-hmm. Els Bells, that's great, instead of Hell's Bells. Austin Weilbacher, or Wielbacher, maybe.
Nice.
Carol Kiesman, or Kiesman, and Eric Scroggins.
Nice.
I was thinking of another guy with the name of Scroggins, but yeah, okay, great.
I didn't know where you were going. Okay, I would like to thank the following Annabelles. Now, this first name, I'm going to say it a few ways.
Okay.
I'm reading it as Taliesin Faye, but I think that's just because I have Taliesin West in my brain. Uh-huh. So it might also be Taliesin Faye. I'm not sure. I'm going to go with Taliesin, though. Colin Miller, Jennifer Morningstar, Truth Seeking, Jess Morton, Karina Benabe, Natalie Shurin, Silver Bullets 23, Courtney Knight, and Zach Barkley.
Nice. I really love the last name Morningstar.
Okay, unfortunately, all it makes me think of is vegetarian sausage patties.
Is that a brand?
Yeah.
Oh, funny.
It's a green box. I love them. They're so delicious.
Huh, it's cool. Yeah, it's like, cool.
Got lots of oats in them. So listen, if you own Morningstar, they would like to sponsor Scared to Death. I will talk for 5 minutes about the deliciousness of vegetarian sausage patties, not the Lynx patties. Okay, can I do some spoopy shoutouts?
Yeah.
Okay, to Tori from Cam, happy birthday. This is great. To Tater Tot from Goofball, happiest of birthdays, happy anniversary, and a huge congrats on your doctorate of physical therapy. I'm so proud of you and excited for our future. Hail Nimrod.
Hail Nimrod.
Can I just say, yes, definitely. Can I just say, I didn't realize until like a couple years ago that physical therapists are doctors.
Not all of them. I don't think. I think you can get different levels of degrees. Because I had a friend who was a physical therapist. He was not a doctor.
But then maybe he was not a physical therapist. I think it has a different name.
Huh.
Because there's like a, almost like a physician's assistant. Like a, you know, like you have like a doctor and then a PA.
Yeah, he worked in he works in physical therapy. I guess I don't know exactly what his title is. But I didn't know that physical therapists...
They're doctors.
Are doctors?
Literally, I just read it to you. A doctor. Well,
no, you can get a doctorate, I know, but I don't know that all physical therapists are doctors.
I'm pretty sure because when I was going, like I was talking to somebody about it, I was like, I mean, I kind of just thought it was the same as being a chiropractor. And then they were like, it's not the same. Like I thought it was the same level of
Oh yeah, chiropractor is its own thing. It's that's a whole.
But I thought it was like certificate, like a chiropractor. I've never met a chiropractor who is a doctor. Or who has a doctorate.
Well, a chiropractor is just someone who got lucky with a box of Cracker Jacks. And they got, their prize was like, hey, you're a chiropractor.
Nice.
I don't know. Sorry.
That was a weird.
A lot of people have problems with chiropractors. I don't know enough about them to mock it.
Good ones are hard to find.
Yeah.
Do you know that we have is he a chiropractor or a physical therapist in town? His name is literally Dr. Bones. His last name is Bones.
Dr. Bones.
I'm like, that was meant for you. Like, this job was chosen for you. Okay, anyways. To whatever karmic energy that has its kiss for me, fuck you, from Ashley, 20 years post-liver transplant, and I'm still going strong. Though my health may have taken a bit of a slide, I'm determined to keep going.
Wow.
I know, that's wild, right?
Yeah, 20 plus years after a liver transplant.
Yeah.
Dang.
To Kara or Kara from Joey, happy birthday. Thanks for being the best sister and best mom to my awesome nephew, Hudson.
Aw.
I know, so sweet.
And I love the nickname Tater Tot, by the way. It's a fairly common one. That is just a fun one. Tater Tot.
My cousin Vince and his daughter, their dog's name was Tater Tot.
Aw, that's a good dog name, too.
So cute.
And that is our show. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else, info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. Thank you to Logan Keith, editing, publishing today's show, doing the scoring as well. Thanks to Heather Rylander, for organizing the My Story emails, and to book editor Drew Atana for polishing and preparing listener stories for book number 5. Thank you to Molly Jean Box for finding the first story I told this week, and Olivia Lee for finding the second. We are on YouTube if you want to watch this show. We're on Facebook and Instagram, where we post pics that accompany episodes and more, @ScaredToDeathPodcast. We also have a private Facebook group, Creeps and Peepers, full of fellow horror lovers. Big thanks to the All-Seeing Eyes, the Creeps and Peepers moderators. You all are fantastic.
Good job.
Enjoy your nightmares, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but has no home here within, scared to death.
Mad Magic Productions.
We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.